Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll tell you about a major endorsement in the race between Amar Campanajar and Duncan Hunter for Congress in the 50th Congressional District. Then hear about the latest twists and turns in a case against El Cajon Councilman Ben Colasio. And also hear why Councilman Colasio has made national news for his attacks on a free press. On Green Scene, we'll tell you about the hottest temperatures ever recorded at our beaches along San Diego's coastline. And then on People Power, hear how our local activists right here in La Mesa have found a way to help immigrant families reunited with their children. Our newsmaker interview today is Richard Carrico. He's an author, anthropologist, historian, educator, and winemaker, and he'll be one of our special guests at our upcoming East County Fest, the party of the decade to celebrate East County Magazine's 10-year anniversary, August 25th at Mission Trails Regional Park, which we'll be telling you all about on today's show. On the second half of our show today, we'll have some national news headlines from Public News Service, including why Attorney General Jeff Sessions may be held in contempt of court, white nationalist protests in Charlottesville, and farmers protesting trade tariffs. Then on Animal Tales, hear about two tiger cubs at Lions, Tigers, and Bears Rescue Facility in Alpine. We'll have rattlesnake safety tips for you, and a heartbreaking story about a Syrian refugee family in El Cajon torn apart by Trump administration changes to refugee policies. We'll have a health alert about dragon's breath snacks and drinks, information about utility rates about to drop after the San Onofre settlement, a Peace Day event in La Mesa, tips from the county on living with coyotes, and a West Fire fundraiser coming up in Alpine, plus Veterans of the Year nominees sought in El Cajon. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is John Fastier with East County Magazine's Capitol Report. Democrat Amar Campanajar has picked up a high-level endorsement for his bid to unseat Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter in the hotly contested 50th Congressional District race. Barack Obama has announced his endorsement of Campanajar, boosting the local contender into the national spotlight. Former President Obama said he's confident that the 81 candidates he endorsed, including Campanajar, together will, quote, strengthen this country we love by restoring opportunity that's broadly shared, repairing our alliances and standing in the world, and upholding our fundamental commitment to justice, fairness, responsibility, and the rule of law. Campanajar served in the Obama administration in the Labor Department and as a White House intern. He says, "We live in divided times, and we have a lot of unfinished work ahead, but I've never been more hopeful for the future. With President Barack Obama guiding the next generation of leaders, the American people can rest assured that hope, unity, and service will be on the ballot this November." His opponent, Congressman Hunter, an Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran, trails Campanajar in fundraising. Despite the heavily Republican registration advantage in the district, one recent poll shows Campanajar rapidly closing the gap among registered voters. Hunter, a staunch supporter of President Donald Trump, remains the target of a federal criminal investigation into allegations that Hunter spent campaign funds on lavish personal expenses, including vacations, jewelry, and his children's school tuition. Hunter has denied wrongdoing, but repaid over $40,000 to his campaign. Hunter's highest-level endorsements to date are Republican Congressman Daryl Issa and former State Senator Joel Anderson.
The legal spiderweb entangling El Cajon Councilman Ben Colosio and his wife, Jessica, has become even stickier. After the Colosios failed repeatedly to respond to requests for admissions in a civil suit, San Diego Superior Court Judge Timothy Taylor has issued an order granting a motion by plaintiff Lena Chari, deeming the contents admitted. Chari, an attorney, is a plaintiff in the case filed by two beauty pageant contestants and a taco shop owner against the Colosios, as well as against a Chamber of Commerce and beauty pageant that they run. The admissions, which the Colosios cannot deny after the judge's ruling, include the Colosios commingled personal assets with assets of the Middle Eastern Chamber of Commerce, which they own, formerly known as the San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce. They also commingled assets of the Miss Middle East Beauty Pageant USA, a nonprofit at the time that they run, and with assets of other business entities and individuals. The chamber never held annual meetings of directors or shareholders, and it has no minutes of any corporate meeting. The Colosios and their entities operated social media accounts under false identities, which were used to maliciously smear Attorney Chari, as well as beauty pageant contestants and that taco shop owner. The Colosios took revenge on Chari, with whom they had a prior legal dispute, by using social media to create a poll which they rigged to rate Chari the worst attorney in San Diego, according to the admissions. The Colosios also used fake internet profiles to make false claims that Chari performed sexual acts in public places, failed the law school admission exam, and was promiscuous. Ben Colosio also engaged in fraudulent business practices by posting false information on social media for the purpose of harming Chari's business and her personal reputation, and to cause her severe emotional distress, according to the admissions. The latest judicial finding in the case comes on the heels of Judge Taylor earlier finding facts true and admissible that Councilman Colosio sexually harassed pageant contestants and offered one contestant the crown if she would have sex with him. The judge's earlier order also deemed admitted that the Colosios used fake accounts to post falsified nude photos of a pageant contestant with whom they had a business dispute, and to defame the taco shop owner with a poll that they controlled after he refused to allow Colosios campaign signs to be posted at his property. On a related matter, Colosio is also accused by Jimmy Parker, attorney for the pageant contestants and taco shop owner, of falsifying real estate documents to hide assets prior to a court judgment in the case. After our reporting revealed that Colosio never obtained a federal employer ID number to secure nonprofit status of his beauty pageant, the state revoked its nonprofit status. Since then, Colosio has refused interviews with East County Magazine. In addition to the allegations over Colosio's conduct in the pending civil case, he is engaged in a pattern of threats and harassments against multiple media outlets and reporters. At the July 11th meeting of the El Cajon City Council, 11 members of the public called for Colosio to resign. However, this week he pulled papers announcing he's planning to run for council. Colosio responded to the criticisms with social media posts encouraging media and the public to, quote, "keep making me famous." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Councilman Ben Colosio's attacks on freedom of the press have drawn national attention. The U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, which tracks attacks on journalists' First Amendment rights in the United States, has published an article on East County Magazine reporter Paul Cruz's police complaint filed against El Cajon Councilman Ben Colosio. Cruz accused Colosio of threatening him with a trained attack dog while Cruz was photographing Colosio's campaign vehicle in the parking lot at the Parkway Plaza shopping mall. Colosio also put defamatory posts on his Facebook page, accusing Cruz of being a psychopathic stalker, despite recognizing Cruz as a reporter who regularly covers El Cajon City Council meetings. Colosio claimed he was afraid of Cruz, despite the fact that Cruz was unarmed, while Colosio had his wife and trained German Shepherd attack dog. Colosio's posts incited death threats against Cruz and were later removed by Facebook. The councilman has a history of attacking the press, including the San Diego Union-Tribune and its award-winning reporter, Jeff McDonald. The U.S. Press Freedom Tracker cites documents selected public threats made to reporters and media organization by U.S. politicians and other public figures, which can have, quote, a chilling effect on journalism. On July 13th, the San Diego Society of Professional Journalists issued a statement defending the rights of journalists and calling on the El Cajon Police Department to fully investigate the attack. Their statement reads, The San Diego chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists is greatly concerned by the behavior of El Cajon City Councilman Ben Colasso toward East County Magazine reporter Paul Cruz, as alleged in Cruz's statements to the police. Threatening or intimidating journalists is unacceptable behavior from any member of the public, but especially from elected officials. The SPJ statement notes that, quote, journalists have a right to do their jobs without fear or violence, and concludes, our institutions and elected officials must do everything they can to ensure the safety of journalists in the exercise of our collective First Amendment right to a free press. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is John Fisteer with a Green Scene Report. Looking to beat the heat? The ocean waters off San Diego are the warmest in a century, reaching a balmy 78.6 degrees Fahrenheit on August 1st to break an all-time record. To put that in perspective, ocean temperatures off Hawaii fluctuate between an average of 78 degrees in winter to 82 degrees in summer. The high temperature locally was measured in water samples off Scripps Pier in La Jolla, taken by researchers from Scripps Institute of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. Scripps oceanographer Reinhard Flick says, like other climate change trends, background warming enhances the probability and magnitude of extreme events. Researchers said that the record warmth is consistent with similar new records for high temperatures set on land, as well as a torrent of extreme weather in 2018, and they predict more records will be broken in the future as climate change intensifies. The changes have led to balmy, bathtub-like temperatures for swimmers off San Diego's shores, but also pose risks to cold water ocean species and, long-term, the survival of many species around the world.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Jonathan Goetz with the People Power Report. La Mesa writer Mimi Pollock believes that helping others is not political. It is good for the soul, she says. Pollock has a long track record of helping others. So when she heard about immigrant parents separated from children, she wanted to help. She first tried bringing toys to children at a detention center, but her offer was declined. Then, a friend told her about a bus station in San Diego, where Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, drops off immigrant parents and children after they are released from custody. Pollock enlisted help from her sister and a friend to fill 5 bags with food, water, and toiletries, then headed to the bus station, a small, outdoor area with benches and an overhang as the only relief from the sweltering sun. On their first trip, they arrived too late. After learning that ICE drops are made mid-afternoon, they returned. A security guard asked for their tickets. After learning of their mission, he told them to wait behind the building. A white van pulled up. 2 mothers and their children got out. After the detention guards left, the mothers came around the building, where they were shocked and thrilled to be given bags of supplies. One mother was from Mexico and the other was from El Salvador. According to Pollock, they were released because they have family members in the U.S. who vouch for them, and whom they will be traveling to rejoin. The mothers wore ankle bracelets and must check in with officials while awaiting court proceedings to determine their long-term fate. The next week, Pollock and her allies returned. This time, they found several families of single mothers and fathers with their children, including families from Mexico, El Salvador, and Honduras, countries where many have fled due to violence. The parents and children thanked Pollock and her friends, while the children joyfully enjoyed cookies provided by their benefactors. One man from Honduras, who was traveling with his 2 sons, looked worried, Pollock recalls. She says, he asked if he could borrow a phone to call his family in Virginia. He didn't have a ticket or any money except for lempiras, Honduran money. We lent him the phone and he reached his family, but he and his young sons had to spend the night at the bus station. Pollock and her group tried to give the family enough food for their overnight stay, but the man was too proud to accept charity, insisting on giving them Honduran money in return. As we parted, Pollock recalls, he said, "Que Dios los bendiga," or "May God bless you." Pollock hopes the man and his sons will find a better life here.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. And today, my very special guest is Richard Carrico. He is one of the authors that you'll be able to meet at our upcoming East County Fest on August 25th in the evening at Mission Trails Regional Park as part of our 10-year anniversary celebration for East County Magazine. Richard is a published author, educator, winemaker, and historian. He's also a lecturer in the Department of American Indian Studies at San Diego State University, and he lives in beautiful Warner Springs. He's a respected scholar and researcher who's made significant contributions to our understanding of local Native American culture and history. He holds degrees in both history and anthropology from San Diego State, and he's a principal in his firm, Recuerdos Research, serving as a consultant to local Indian tribes, government agencies, and companies. His primary area of research is the Indian people of Southern California and Northern Mexico. And he's also an enthusiast of wine, food, and ancient history. He's authored over 30 publications in professional journals, and he's the author of numerous books, including History of Wines and Wineries of San Diego County, Images of America series, Ramona, and Strangers in a Stolen Land, The Indians of San Diego County from Prehistory to the New Deal. Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here with you.
So tell us, what sparked your interest in these fields? How did you first get involved in or interested in archaeology and history locally?
Well, I was always interested in history, even going back as a child. And I served in the Army, and while I was over in South Korea, I worked with a general who was a historian out of Rutgers, and we drove all over South Korea looking at shrines and ancient buildings. When I came back after the Army, I actually started out as a medieval and Renaissance historian. It's a far cry from local San Diego history.
Yeah, fascinating.
And so I had to take an elective class to fulfill my requirements to finish my degree in Renaissance and medieval history, and the only one that was open was an archaeology class out in Spring Valley, the Bancroft Ranch House. So I took that class, and about halfway through the semester, I was so enthralled with finding a piece of pottery from 1,000 years ago or an arrowhead from 2,000 years ago that I went back and changed my major. I finished the degree in Renaissance and medieval history, but took another degree 2 years later in anthropology, and then later went back and took a master's in history, but with an emphasis in local tribes. So that's how I got into the archaeology field and the anthropology field.
A lot of people are surprised to learn that our local Kumeyaay tribes, Kumeyaay Nation, traces its history back some, they used to say 10,000, and now they're saying 12,000 years after finding some even more ancient artifacts recently. I mean, if you think about that, that's older than the pyramids of Giza, older than a lot of the ancient civilizations.
Absolutely. One of the comparisons I use is if we looked at history of people in San Diego County as being 1 hour long, the Europeans that we talk so much about with the missions and all the buildings and the roads and the architecture have been here 1 minute.
Wow. So what are a couple of the most fascinating facts that people might learn in your book, Strangers in a Stolen Land?
In that book, I try to jump from archaeology and prehistory or pre-contact, that is before Europeans got here, to the 1930s. And what I've noticed, a takeaway that people get is just what you mentioned, Miriam, that people have been here probably closer to 12 to 13,000 years ago, and that the ancient sites are probably under the ocean, that the water has been rising for 10,000 years.
Wow.
And the oldest sites have probably fallen off the cliffs, and they've been covered by water. And we have over 16,000 sites in San Diego County.
That's amazing. And of course, where our August 25th is going to be, East County Fest at Mission Trails, that was one of the, I guess, original places where the Kumeyaay used to live. What can you tell us about that place specifically?
Yeah, Mission Trails Regional Park was a Kumeyaay village. It was the closest village to Mission San Diego, except for the village right where Mission San Diego is. And many of the people, the Kumeyaay people who built Mission San Diego and the Presidio, lived in the village right there at Mission Trails Park. And on some of the hikes that you can take, you can see the grinding holes, the mortars, where they process the acorns. There is a rock painting site that you're not allowed to go to, a pictograph, but they have a depiction of it there in the park. Springs, water, acorns, sage, plants, rabbits, deer. It was a perfect place to live, and there have been sites dated there at 6,000 years ago.
Wow. And I know that they have a model of a Kumeyaay. Which is what they call their homes. Yeah, exactly. Made out of willow, isn't it?
Made out of willows, right?
Yeah, you can see that right there at the visitor center.
Yeah.
And we're also going to have Native American flute players there, as well as other live music. If you're coming to the event on August 25th, there's going to be guitar players with music ranging from jazz to classical to pop to folk to nuevo flamenco and more.
Miles Moynihan and Jim Earp, both very well-known and award-winning guitarists, will be performing, and also the talented dancers from Visionary Dance Theater.
That's great.
Also an artist, Chuck McPherson, who's very well-known. He's won over 100 juried art shows. He's known around the world. He's going to be live painting a painting for the auction. And then we have foods and wines from some 17 different restaurants and wineries so far, and about, I think, 7 or 8 different authors signing their books, including Richard. The autographed books will be part of our raffle and auction, and we're also going to have some autographed memorabilia with NBA superstar Bill Walton, who you can meet if you come to the event. And tickets for the event are available on our website at eastcountymagazine.org, and the early bird rates are in effect up through August 14th. And that's all to benefit our nonprofit, News in the Public Interest with East County Magazine, as well as our East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts, keeping you safe and informed across East County. Now, Richard, you're also a winemaker, and you've got a book out on San Diego wines, and I'm sure a lot of the wine lovers coming to this event and probably lots of other listeners out there will be interested to hear more. How did you get into that?
I got into wine generally because growing up I had a sister who was very much into wine and good food, and back in the 60s and early 70s, there was frankly not a lot of good restaurants in San Diego, but she would take me to the best ones, and I really developed an appreciation of wine pretty early. And then I worked in the restaurant business for a while at different restaurants around town, and again saw that pairing of wine and food as a natural extension of the land and of what you can grow and what you can eat. And about 20 years ago, I decided I wanted to know a lot more about making of wine and the appreciation of it. So I started taking classes at UC Davis and learned about planting a vineyard, keeping the vineyard healthy, picking the grapes and making wine.
So you were producing Zinfandel and Tempranillo wine, two of my favorites, I understand.
Absolutely.
And then, unfortunately, a tragedy struck. Tell us about that.
I had planted a vineyard in Ramona and had about 200 plants and was on the verge of, in fact, being bonded legally to sell the wine. And the Cedar Fire came through in October of 2003, right after I had harvested. So luckily for me, the juice, if you will, was all somewhere else, fermenting and finishing up. But it rushed through the vineyard, burnt down the fences, and did, in fact, kill some of the new plants I had planted.
This would be a good time to mention, by the way, that our event benefits both East County Magazine and also our East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts that are so important for helping to keep people safe. During the West Fire in Alpine, we had our first alerts out 6 minutes after the fire started, and it was only a few minutes after that that homes began burning down. So it was critical. We were actually the very first alert service to get word out about that fire. I think we beat all the other ones by well over an hour.
And there needs to be a lot of that. We left our house in Ramona at 6:15 in the morning, and it burned down at 7 o'clock. And we lived on Mussy Grade Road with only one way in and one way out.
So hard hit up there.
The East County has its problems there. So that was the beginning. And one of the things that San Diego's blessed with in terms of growing grapes and making wine is we have a very Mediterranean climate. Some areas are more arid than others, but mm-hmm. we have little microclimates, Ramona versus Dulzura versus Jamul.
And they've been making wine here all the way back to the 1700s when the early Spanish missionaries came through and they were making the mission wines. San Diego, East County was actually the grape growing capital of California at one time.
Right before Prohibition and going back to the mission, we started making essentially wine in about 1784, 83, because mm-hmm. it took some years for the vines to catch on. They were from Peru. They were brought up from Peru by cuttings. It's called the mission grape.
Right.
And then by right before Prohibition, we had about 40 wineries, 35 to 40 bonded wineries, which was more than Sonoma at the time.
And then, of course, Prohibition sort of put the kibosh on that.
Prohibition did, and even though we did ship some grapes back east, as other folks did in Sonoma and Napa, we didn't do as much because the train system wasn't as tuned in as it was coming out of the north.
Right, and officially they had to be table grapes, right? Although I know there was a little bending of the rules, even locally on that.
Little bending, and in fact, the carton that it came in actually told you, don't do these things. Don't let them ferment. Don't add any sugar. Don't keep them at this temperature, or it'll turn into wine.
So there's a lot of bathtub winemaking going on.
There's a lot of bathtub winemaking going on.
Yeah, and then, of course, it resurged, and now it's become really a premier winemaking region once again.
It truly has. I mean, the beer and the craft beer has received a great deal of attention because it exploded on the scene and because there's a lot, probably more beer drinkers than wine drinkers. But in fact, we're probably approaching 100 wineries, bonded wineries in San Diego County, certainly over 85.
And most of those are in East County. You're going to get to taste a lot of them at our event.
And and out in the East County, there's been that revigoration also of, and you have some of the wines showing up at the event.
Right, which again, for those of you who just tuned in, it's going to be August 25th in the evening at Mission Trails Regional Park, and the advance tickets are available now at eastcountymagazine.org.
So, the wine business just has grown so much, but the roots are the first winery. So some people ask me, what did you learn in writing this book? Well, when I started, I thought I knew. This is kind of like being in graduate school. You get out of graduate school, you think you know everything. Mm-hmm. When I started the book, I thought I knew exactly where it was going. But I found out that the first winery, bonded commercial winery in San Diego County, was actually in Valley Center, of all places, at a rancho called Rancho Guajito.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then it spread from there. Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. Now, you studied viticulture at UC Davis, which is certainly known for as one of the, probably the premier educational opportunity for people who want to learn about winemaking in California, and you're continuing to wait to make wines to this day, I understand.
I do. Where I live now in Warner Springs, I'm not growing grapes because there are so many people in the county now growing very, very good grapes, and some want to just grow grapes and sell them to people like me to make wine out of. Mm-hmm. So a couple of years ago, I started purchasing wine from Ramona, mm-hmm. a place called Pyramid Vineyards, right off of Magnolia and Highway 78 there as it leaves town. So I make Cabernet Sauvignon and Malbec.
And if you want to taste some of Richard's wines, he's generously donating some for our auction that we're going to be having at East County Fest on August 25th, so you can come on out and maybe you'll be the lucky winner.
Absolutely.
Now, another book that you're going to have there is from your Images of America series. This one is on Ramona. What can you tell us about the history of Ramona?
Well, if you look at Ramona in terms of history of people, again, the Kumeyaay tribe, now a nation, have sites that go back there 6,000 to 8,000 years, and some of us familiar with that drive when you come out of near Poway and you go up to Mount Woodson and you mm-hmm. make that curve at Mount Woodson. Mount Woodson was a very, and still is, a sacred mountain to the Kumeyaay people.
Yeah.
It's called Moon Mountain. So in the book, which is largely photographs with captions on it, it starts out with the Native American people and who they were a little bit and how they lived out in the valleys. But the town itself, of course, takes its name from a book that Helen Hunt Jackson wrote back in 1884, 1885 about a woman. It's a fictional account of a true person named Ramona, whose husband was killed by white people, and then her family suffered and she had to leave the area. And the town, to honor her and the book, because it's hard to imagine how popular that book was, but it was the Gone with the Wind of the 1880s.
Wow.
And it actually, if you look at it per capita, would have outsold Shades of Grey or Gone with the Wind per capita
Amazing.
In America. And it affected a lot of people.
So how did the real life Ramona differ from the fictionalized, romanticized version in the book.
Well, Helen Hunt Jackson was a pro-Indian advocate, and what she really was trying to do was get Congress to pass laws to help the Native Americans. She'd written a nonfiction book, which nobody read, even though she gave copies to Congress. So she romanticized it a little bit. She changed the name. She changed some of the locations. But it's largely factual, and people have written academic papers and dissertations on the real Ramona.
Wow.
And one time you could take a train out here to San Diego, and you could then go up north towards Hemet and Murrieta, and you could go to Ramona's house. Mm-hmm. Of course, there were two or three. You could go to her burial place. There were two.
Yeah.
And you could go to Old Town, to Ramona's marriage place, where she never was. It became very touristy in that sense. But it did, in fact, help the Native Americans, and some good legislation was passed out of it.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize that San Diego County actually has more Native American reservations than any other county in America. That's amazing.
We do. It's one of the questions on my final in my class. And the distinction is we have 19 reservations, so we have the most of any county in the United States, not the highest population, and certainly not the largest. If you took all of our reservations and you put them in a bag and you dropped them into the Navajo reservation, they would disappear. But we do have 19, and it represents three different tribal groups, the Kuwiya, the Luiseno, and the Kumeyaay,
right,
speaking three different languages going back thousands of years.
Yeah, amazingly rich heritage here. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Richard Carrico, who is an author, educator, winemaker, and historian, and archaeologist. And he's one of the authors that's going to be signing copies of his books and available for you to meet and learn more at our upcoming East County Fest, which is our 10-year anniversary party for East County Magazine. It'll be August 25th from 6 to 10 p.m. at Mission Trails Regional Park with a VIP party at 5:30. And you can get tickets at eastcountymagazine.org. Richard, I'm going to let you have the final say. What else would you like our listeners to know today?
Well, I think one thing is we could have started this interview out by saying we are in Kumeyaay territory and we're blessed to be here. And I would have given you the greeting of Hauka or Hauka, which means hello, but what it really means is to your health and of the land. It's like aloha is in Hawaiian. It means a lot of different things. So really look forward to seeing some of you out there on the 25th, and there's going to be a whole array of authors and good wine and good food and music, and in some ways certainly the best of San Diego.
That was the idea. We're calling it the best of East County. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast. I'm Mike Clifford. Attorney General Jeff Sessions threatened with contempt charges for allegedly jumping the gun on deportation. Also on the Friday rundown in Charlottesville, counter-protesters could outnumber white nationalists. And farmers reveal a new campaign against tariffs. It was a dramatic scene in federal court. Federal officials had begun to deport a plaintiff in a major immigration lawsuit in defiance of a court-approved agreement to keep her stateside during the case. It prompted the judge to threaten Attorney General Jeff Sessions with contempt charges on Thursday. Think Progress reports Department of Justice attorneys had agreed not to deport the woman, identified in court papers by the pseudonym of Carmen, at least until midnight Thursday. But ACLU attorneys learned that Carmen and her young daughter had been moved out of the Texas detention facility where they were being held as the lawyers stood before Judge Emmett Sullivan in Washington, D.C. MSNBC reports the judge ordered the plane chartered by ICE to turn back in midair. The woman and her daughter are now back in ICE detention in Texas. With a state of emergency declared ahead of the one-year anniversary of violence that sprung from a white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, fewer disruptions are expected this weekend, despite the continued rise of hate groups and hate speech.
Several events planned in the Charlottesville area through Sunday mostly involve groups aiming to counter hate and prejudice. Heidi Byrick at the Southern Poverty Law Center tracks the nation's hate group activity and says so far she's seen no indication that white supremacists will return to Charlottesville this weekend, although there might be a few.
And I think the city and this decision to declare a state of emergency is a good preemptive step. just to make sure that we don't end up with the sad outcomes like we did last year with Heather Heyer's death and the other violence.
Organizers of last year's Unite the Right rally are planning to hold their follow-up event in Washington, D.C., claiming they'll be protesting civil rights abuses in Charlottesville. Counter-demonstrations have also received permits, including Black Lives Matter and an individual who plans to burn a Confederate flag in Lafayette Park. I'm Tramell Gomes.
Emergency response timing is key in active shooter situations. Wisconsin is examining new technology to get emergency personnel to the scene more quickly. Mapping technology used by military special operations is now seen as a tool for emergency responders to get a detailed map of a building, rooms, hallways, entrances, and exits. Police Chief Tom Stika says the technology presented at the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association Summer Conference is part of the effort to gather and review tactics to keep schools safe, including for the possibility of a gunman on campus.
God forbid something like this happened in the state of Wisconsin, we will be having resources coming in from all over the place. As a result, many officers certainly don't know where the library is in an adjacent jurisdiction's high school.
Stika says the technology created by BAE Systems shows promise because it brings some of the most important information to an emergency responder's fingertips, accessible on their phones or squad car computers. Environmental groups are concerned that a long-standing conservation program that's benefited every state could expire next month.
The Land and Water Conservation Fund is funded entirely by revenue from offshore oil leases. The 50-year-old program has supported everything from national parks and forests to hiking trails and swimming pools in virtually every county in the nation. Ed Perry with the National Wildlife Federation in Pennsylvania calls it the best conservation program the public has never heard of.
Here in Pennsylvania, we've been especially blessed. With matching grants from the fund, the state has funded over 1,500 projects throughout Pennsylvania.
Though initially authorized for two 25-year periods, in 2015, Congress reauthorized the Land and Water Conservation Fund for only 3 years. Without action, it could expire on September 30th of this year. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And finally, Ross Brown reports on the same day Farmers for Free Trade said it's stepping up its campaign to encourage farmers to let President Donald Trump know that tariffs are hurting the ag industry. China announced additional tariffs on U.S. imports.
Farmers for Free Trade will spend $800,000 on radio, print, online, and television ads across the heartland, including the states of Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Michigan, South Dakota, and others. The bipartisan association's Tariffs Hurt the Heartland campaign also will include town hall events in various states. Matt McElvana with Farmers for Free Trade says the group is at the Minnesota Farm Fest this week to collect stories from farmers that will appear in the advertising campaign.
Because right now there's just this wave of anecdotes of pain, job loss, and plummeting prices. So this new campaign is actually going to tell the stories that we are hearing.
At a FarmFest forum this week, representatives with the Democratic Party questioned the purpose of the tariffs, and some calling them reckless, while Republican representatives said patience is needed and farmers should trust the president. Have a great weekend. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome. This is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales.
This is Brianna Gomez with East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Mocha, a Bengal hybrid tiger cub, rescued from smugglers at the border, has a new home at the Lions, Tigers, and Bears Sanctuary in Alpine. Recently, Mocha was released into the Tiger Trails exercise area at the facility with his new companion Nola, a young white tiger rescued in New Orleans. Aaron Dean with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in San Diego says, quote, "Smuggling wildlife across the border occurs almost on a daily basis," but adds that finding a tiger cub is rare. Smugglers of exotic wildlife can face up to 20 years in federal prison. The two people responsible for smuggling Mocha were U.S. citizens, affiliated with a drug cartel, according to Joseph Meisenhalter with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. When border agents realized they were dealing with a tiger, they immediately contacted the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Mocha was initially sent to the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, but was not conducive to the zoo's breeding program, so he was sent to lions, tigers, and bears, a, quote, no-kill, no-breed sanctuary that allows animals to live out their lives with dignity, according to their website's mission statement. David Shaw with Homeland Security says the department usually deals with contraband drugs, not wildlife. During interviews at the border, agents determine whether the individuals are intentional smugglers or simply misinformed tourists. While tiger smuggling makes headlines, smaller species are also prey for smugglers. For instance, U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents voice concern over totoba, a rare indigenous fish to the Gulf of Mexico that is being smuggled across the border for the use of its bladder in a Chinese soup. Totoba poaching also threatens endangered vaquita porpoises, which are caught in the nets of totoba fishers. Fortunately, the tiger cub Mocha is safe in his new home at Lions, Tigers, and Bears, a 93-acre property in Alpine started by Bobby Brink in 2002. Brink got the idea while living in Texas, where she opened a restaurant. While reading ads for restaurant equipment, she also found ads selling exotic animals. She ended up volunteering with the woman raising the animals and found out more about the exotic animal trade. She's been working to ban private ownership of exotic animals. Meanwhile, she and her husband, along with staff and volunteers at Lions, Tigers, and Bears, are dedicated to providing these animals with fulfilling lives in an ethical environment. The animals are provided access to exercise enclosures, like tiger trails, with a pond, grass, and climbing areas. Brink says, quote, "We can't put these animals in the wild, so we try to give them their best lives that we can possibly provide, so they can at least live out their lives in dignity." The site also has an educational program, so people can visit and learn about wild animals and the issues of wild animal trade. Brink used her own capital to start the organization and was self-funded for several years. Lions, Tigers, and Bears now has larger sponsors and is a registered sanctuary that operates solely from donations and revenues from visitors. For more information on getting involved or visiting the sanctuary in Alpine, you can visit lionstigersandbears.org.
Hot weather brings a timely warning from the Santee Fire Department. The agency posted a photo on Facebook of one of its firefighters removing a red diamondback rattlesnake from a backyard on aptly named Rattlesnake Mountain. Santee Fire Department's post says it's an all-hazards department, meaning snake wrangling is all part of the job, but this was one of the biggest snakes it's captured. The snake, held at arm's length via a snake hook tool, appeared longer than the height of the firefighter. That's over 6 feet. The department offers this advice to remember. Don't put your hands or feet where you can't see, and always look before stepping over doorsteps, since snakes like to crawl along the sides of buildings. If you do see a rattlesnake, freeze, then back up slowly to avoid frightening the reptile. If you are bitten, seek medical help immediately, since rattlesnake bites can be life-threatening without treatment, including anti-venom. Reporting for East County Magazine and Santee, this is Jonathan Getz.
Huda El-Sidnawi arrived in the United States in 2016 with both of her parents and her two younger sisters, now ages 16 and 10. The family left Syria in 2012, at the brink of the civil war, and immigrated to Egypt, where they obtained appropriate documentation to enter the United States on refugee visas. Today, Huda and her family live in El Cajon, where many other Middle Eastern refugees have been relocated over the past decade or more. But her older brother Ahmed has been blocked from joining his family here due to the Trump administration reversing an Obama-era decision to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees. Huda has also been kept apart from her fiancé, a Syrian engineering student living in Egypt. The two met and got engaged before Huda came to the United States. Her brother Ahmed left Egypt and went to Turkey, where he hoped to pursue an advanced education. Due to financial hardship, he ended up working in Turkey, where he still resides, stuck in limbo as he waits on documentation to be approved so that he can join his family. The family has been separated from him for over 5 years. They have told their story among the activist communities, spoken with congressional representatives, and talked with multiple immigration attorneys. But so far, he has not been able to come to the United States. Huda recently completed her high school degree and has been attending community college, hoping to pursue an associate degree in English. She stayed busy by giving lectures hosted by SDSU and other organizations about her experience as a refugee, and talks about her home country in classes of local Arabic learners who want to know more about the Middle East. Her father, who was a hairstylist and barber in Syria for 30 years, hopes to improve his English skills so that he can enter the workforce in his own career. Her mother, a caring figure who watches many children in her neighborhood and community, hopes to pursue a career in child care. She's also an excellent cook and has been asked to help cater a few Middle Eastern events. Huda plans to return to Egypt this year to get married and hopes that her future husband will be able to obtain a permanent visa to follow her back to San Diego so the two can start their lives together. The separation from her brother and fiancé has caused Huda great anxiety. This anxiety is common among refugee communities who are forced to leave their homes amid strenuous conditions and relocate in places where they often face discrimination or separation due to changing immigration policies, according to the United Nations. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees reports that the Syrian conflict has resulted in the largest refugee crisis since World War II. The UN conducted a study on Syrian refugees in Jordan, which found that, quote, absence of key family members exacerbates financial burdens, resulting in increased stress, child labor, debt accumulation, and strained relationships with host communities. Huda says she and her family are thankful for the opportunity to come to America, but she implores, quote, please, if you're going to bring someone, just let us complete the family. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Brianna Gomez.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This is Brianna with a health alert. A trendy snack called Dragon's Breath is sending some consumers, including teenagers, to the hospital with serious burns and internal injuries, the Washington Post and other media outlets report. The snack is made from colorful cereal balls similar to Fruit Loops or other snack items drenched with liquid nitrogen, which freezes to around minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit. The Dragon's Breath user then blows out condensed moisture that looks like smoke. The concoction originated in Asia around 2015 and made its way to the U.S. when a chef introduced it into a Los Angeles restaurant. Diners are advised to use a stick to eat Dragon's Breath tidbits and never touch it with their hands, but that advice is sometimes ignored, and even when directions are followed, some have suffered serious harm. A 14-year-old Florida girl who touched a Dragon's Breath snack at a county fair nearly had to have her thumb amputated. The fair has said it will not allow Dragon's Breath to be sold there next year. Others have suffered burns to their mouth, esophagus, and stomach from liquid nitrogen, which is also popping up in drinks. A British woman reportedly had her stomach removed after drinking a liquid nitrogen cocktail in a bar. The substance can also cause deadly asphyxiation if inhaled, since it displaces oxygen, and it can damage vision if it comes into contact with your eyes. Liquid nitrogen is the same substance used by doctors to burn off precancerous skin lesions and by some exterminators who pump liquid nitrogen into walls to freeze and kill termites. Vendors of liquid nitrogen snacks and drinks typically warn customers not to touch the items except with a stick, blow on it several times before consuming, chew Dragon's Breath before swallowing, and never drink the liquid left in the cup. The safest option, however, is to avoid Dragon's Breath and other foods or beverages containing liquid nitrogen.
Under the final settlement agreement reached with utilities over closure of the San Onofre Nuclear Generation Station, ratepayers will have a decrease in rates starting November 1st. San Diego Gas and Electric announced that the average bill will be reduced by about $6.84 a month for 2 months. There will also be a long-term reduction of just under 1%, or about $1.33 a month for the average residential electric utility ratepayer. Non-residential ratepayers can also expect a modest reduction in their bills. SDG&E will be reimbursed by Southern California Edison for those reductions, which are estimated to cost around $160 million. Under the settlement, the California Public Utilities Commission agreed to remove a provision that would have funded university-conducted research on greenhouse gases. Dan Skopek, SDG&E Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, says, "This settlement is good for our customers and is a positive conclusion to the investigation." The plant was decommissioned in 2013 after low-level radiation leaks were detected due to faulty equipment. The settlement comes after a multi-year state investigation into the closure of the nuclear facility. In 2014, The parties reached a settlement approved by the California Public Utilities Commission. But after allegations of improper communications between Edison and the CPUC surfaced, however, the CPUC reopened the proceeding. No violations were alleged to have been committed by SDG&E, and no penalties were assessed on SDG&E. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
The Interfaith Council of La Mesa will hold its fifth annual Peace and Justice event on Sunday, September 16th, from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m. at the La Mesa Community Center as part of International Day of Peace. The theme declared by the United Nations is Together for Peace, Respect, Justice, and Dignity for All. Representatives from multiple faith traditions will voice commitment to promote peace and justice, support diversity, non-discrimination, and respect for all. After presentations, there will be opportunities to learn about outreach activities of local churches and faith traditions, as well as sharing ideas on ways to bring about peace and justice locally and globally. All are welcome to attend the Peace Day event. For more information, you can visit interfaithlamesa.org. Reporting for East County Magazine in La Mesa, this is Brianna Gomez.
Next up, we have a story from County News Service on living with coyotes, where a county representative interviews County Animal Services Director Dan D'Souza.
Coyotes. It seems every so often they claw themselves back into the media where they are portrayed as vicious predators. Coyotes can cause problems in urban neighborhoods, but there's little evidence that they deserve to be vilified as dangerous beasts.
What they've learned is that backyards have cat food and dog food left out all the time. People's gardens have vegetables and fruit that have fallen to the ground. That is taking the coyotes, luring them from out of the canyons in their open spaces into our own backyards.
Of course, pet owners living close to open space need to take extra precautions.
If you want to keep your cat absolutely 100% safe, keep it indoors. If it's outdoors and it's running loose, there's a chance it can be eaten by a coyote. There's a chance it can be hit by a car. You know, keep them in the house and you know they're going to be safe.
If you have small dogs, don't leave them unattended in your backyard.
If you see coyotes jumping into people's yards, there's a very easy technique to prevent that, and it's called a coyote roller. Basically, you, on the top of your fence, you stretch a metal cable from post to post, and over that cable, you just put a small piece of PVC pipe. A coyote, when he jumps up, and they can clear a 5-foot fence pretty easily, a 6-foot fence, they're going to reach up and put their paws on the top of the fence. If that PVC rolls, the coyote cannot get traction and will fall back to the other side.
One way to keep them out of your community is a technique known as coyote hazing. Now, that doesn't mean breaking out your fraternity paddles. It simply means that you want to make the coyote feel unwelcome. Wave your hand, shout, whatever it takes to scare them off.
You want to make that animal afraid of people and afraid to come back into our communities. So if you see a coyote and you stomp and yell and scream at it and it turns and runs away 10 feet and stops and looks back at you, take a couple steps forward and scream and yell at it again. You need to make sure that coyote knows, I'm not welcome here. It's not safe for me to be here.
Los Penasquitos Canyon Preserve borders several housing developments. It spans nearly 4,000 acres and has more than 10 miles of trails. A supervising ranger here says he hasn't had one negative coyote incident in the 12 years he's been here.
When people see coyotes in the canyon, sometimes they get a little bit alarmed and they want to come and tell the ranger they saw a coyote down the road. I let them know that that's probably a wonderful thing that they saw, and they have to realize that they are in a wild area, in an open space preserve, and this is where coyotes are supposed to be. We ask for people to keep their dogs on a leash at all times. Some people don't like that, and they ask us why. Primarily, it's to keep their dogs safe. What will happen is, as they're running loose off a leash, whether they're large or small, it can easily be drawn away or attacked by a coyote that is simply an opportunistic hunter and sees this prey coming by.
When you see these people that have leashes that are 20 feet long, they can't protect that animal if there's a coyote in those bushes 20 feet ahead. That coyote will jump out and snatch that animal instantly.
So why not just trap and remove the coyotes living here? Some even ask about killing the animals to decrease the sheer numbers of coyotes. Well, those methods have been attempted across the country, and it just doesn't work.
Coyotes play an integral role in the ecosystem. If you get rid of a coyote, and that's what we always hear, can't you just kill this coyote? Can't you trap it and relocate it? doing so means that prey population that that coyote has been living on, the rabbits and the mice and the rats, is going to explode. Nature has a way of balancing itself out. When those prey populations explode, that's going to actually draw in more coyotes into the community. So again, we need to learn to live with them, but keep them in the open spaces and in the canyons where they rightfully belong.
Coyotes are here to stay. It's up to us to find ways of coexisting with them. We need to accept and even enjoy that wildlife as part of our environment. When you hear the chorus of coyotes late at night, it's them telling us, humans and pets alike, that this is their home.
Now, if you would like to help survivors of the West Fire in Alpine, there will be a dinner and auction to benefit them on Saturday, August 18th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. at the Alpine Community Center. The Alpine Mountain Empire Chamber of Commerce and Alpine Community Center are organizing the fundraiser. All money raised will be donated to the Alpine Community Foundation to help and support those affected by the West Fire, which destroyed 34 homes and also destroyed many outbuildings, damaging other properties as well. For tickets and more information, you can visit alpinechamber.com.
The City of El Cajon Veterans Commission is seeking nominations for its Veteran of the Year Award, recognizing those who go above and beyond in serving their community through their leadership abilities and or community services in El Cajon. Final selections will be based on dedication, commitment, and the impact on those served by the veterans' volunteer work since leaving the military. Nominees must be residents in the City of El Cajon and honorably discharged from the U.S. military or National Guard. If you know of a veteran who has gone the extra mile to improve the quality of life in the community, please take this opportunity to acknowledge and reward that effort. Current Veterans Commissioners are not eligible. Nominations are being accepted now through September 14th, and nomination forms are available at the City of El Cajon's website on the Veterans Commission page. For more information, call 619-441-1754. Winners of the award will be honored on Veterans Day, November 11th, at the Veterans Memorial in front of City Hall. They will also be presented with a Veteran of the Year award plaque and proclamation during the El Cajon City Council meeting on December 11th. Additionally, a perpetual plaque will be displayed in the lobby at City Hall. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Eileen Bays.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.